From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. It's been nearly 2 months since Hamas launched an attack on southern Israel and killed 1,400 men, women, and children. More than 200 more people were abducted and taken back to Gaza as hostages, including citizens of Israel, America, Russia, Nepal, and elsewhere. Since then, Israel's retaliatory war against Hamas has led to many more thousands of Palestinians in Gaza to be killed, mostly civilians and many, many children. Meanwhile, in Europe, Ukraine is closing on 2 years of fighting off Russia's invasion of its country. In this challenging environment, we've occasionally checked in with Ian Kelly, the ambassador in residence at Northwestern University. He began his career in the U.S. Foreign Service in the last years of the Soviet Union. He held a variety of high-level roles in the State Department and served as the department's spokesman under then-Secretary Hillary Clinton. From 2010 to 2013, he was U.S. representative to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe and then was ambassador to the country of Georgia. And he joins us now. Ian Kelly, thank you for being with us again today on The 21st Show.
It's great to be with you, Brian. Thank you for having me.
Listeners, as ever, you're invited to join our conversation today at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. All right, I just want to begin with your sort of, we first spoke in the first weeks after the Hamas went into southern Israel, and I should acknowledge, I know this is not your primary area of global expertise, but you were a diplomat for many years, you were at the top level of the State Department. How generally do you think that Israel's military response to Hamas's actions have sort of gone? How have they shaped the current phase of this conflict we're in?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, I think that one of the big issues, well, there are several big issues, but first of all, a real challenge for Israel, of course, is the goal of eliminating Hamas. And the reason why it is so difficult is because Gaza is one of the most crowded and compact urban areas in the world. 2 million Palestinians live in a fairly small area, mostly in high-rise apartments. And so it is probably any military commander's worst nightmare trying to clear out an enemy which is deeply embedded in a very, very crowded urban zone. So I think the United States is very supportive of Israel's right to defend itself. I think where the problem is that by using overwhelming force, they are sending really extremely distressing images out and stories out about mass civilian casualties. So the other big issue is, what's their strategy? We know what their tactic is, but what happens if and when they do attain their goal of destroying Hamas? What happens to the reconstruction and the restoration of civilians to these areas, which are you know, extremely destroyed? Most of the housing stock there is destroyed. And I think the administration is frustrated because it's not getting clear signals from the Israeli government what the plan is for the long term.
And there have been stories about that, right? Them pressing the Israeli government about,
yes,
what do you want? What will governance in Gaza look like, right? Will it
right,
be Israel?
Right.
Will it be a, you know, some sort of new iteration of the Palestinian Authority?
Yeah. Well, I think we've been pretty clear that it has to be the Palestinian Authority. I mean, nobody wants Hamas. At least the Palestinian Authority has cooperated with the Israeli government and, more importantly, has recognized Israel's right to exist, where Hamas hasn't. But, I think that Secretary of Defense Austin put it very succinctly. He said to Israeli leaders, and then he reiterated this publicly, that that they could achieve a tactical victory, but it would be a strategic defeat if they don't if they don't protect civilians more, provide more aid, provide more refuge, and most importantly, provide an alternative to Hamas. So I think the administration is frustrated because the alternative, the only one they can see, is the Palestinian Authority, you know, which rules in the West Bank. But it seems that the Netanyahu government is not even willing to countenance that. And so there's really no clear solution to this horrible situation with the future of the Palestinians. He seems to be, in many ways, kind of cutting off or precluding the idea of Palestinian self-governance. And, you know, most American officials, if not all senior American officials, see that as the only solution. A separate Palestinian state, Palestine, governed by Palestinians, with, of course, security guarantees worked into it, whether it's demilitarization or other means.
You know, I was reading about some of the past peace negotiations Israel undertook with its neighbors, and it was Aaron David Miller, I think, who said it was easier in some ways, was involved in a lot of these under, I think, Presidents Carter, Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and says it was easier in some ways to deal on a state-to-state basis, right? Israel could deal with the leadership of Egypt or Jordan as opposed to the Palestinian movement, which lacks a sort of centralized authority and the, you know, control of a state actor, right? People who can actually make a deal and then live by it or force it to be accepted. I wonder if you have a perspective on that and whether that is, you know, one of the challenges that we face now.
It's a huge challenge. And I think the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank has not really, to put it mildly, inspired confidence in terms of their competence. They have not done a real good job of governing the West Bank. There have been accusations of corruption. The leader of the Palestinian Authority is 88 years old. Hasn't faced the voters for over a decade. I don't know how many years it's been that they haven't had elections there. So it is a very challenging situation to try and find some kind of transition to a Palestinian state based on the track record of both the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and Hamas in Gaza. But the tragic fact is there's no solution to this until the Palestinians are able to govern themselves. So there has to be some kind of internationally supervised transition at some point. And and the Israelis haven't really shown any signs that they're willing to accept that. They don't trust the UN. The Arab states don't trust Israel, and they don't want to be connected with an Israeli victory over Hamas. As one leader said, we're not going to go into Gaza on the backs of Israeli tanks. So it's really, really difficult. But the only solution I can see is the Palestinian Authority, because they have recognized the right of Israel to exist. But it is a terrible situation. For U.S. diplomacy, for international diplomacy, and most importantly for the Israelis and the Palestinians themselves.
Yeah. We're speaking with Ian Kelly, ambassador in residence at Northwestern University. 800-222-9455 is the number to join our conversation today. We did hear from some people via text message Some who just had some questions, and we'll get to those. Others who, you know, were sort of expressing their opinions on this. We heard Tommy in Urbana say people have designed a system in the Middle East over time that will never work and no one will ever be happy and productive. A pretty pessimistic note from Tommy there. We got another message from John in Rockford. It's too long to read the whole thing, but you can get a flavor of it by noting that he refers to the, quote, Zionist invaders of 1948 and what he called a Jewish apartheid regime today. That's from John's comments. I guess that segues into Ian Kelly. It seems to me that in America now, the response, the support of Israel is not what it once was, particularly on the left, among some young people. There's been a number of polls out that people are very dissatisfied. I think in the last, saw a story in Politico recently that there's a group of Muslim Americans who are saying, that they're ready to drop President Biden, their support for President Biden, and that could be important in states like Michigan and elsewhere and heading into next year's elections. I wonder what you make of this change in attitude among Americans that we've started to see. I imagine you're seeing it on campus at Northwestern.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's a very, I think among American undergraduates, among students in America, there's a very polarized atmosphere with pro-Israeli students on one side and pro-Palestinian on the other. I'm not sure how this situation got to where it is now. I think one of the reasons is just a lack of a diplomatic process. All of the various international mechanisms, the Oslo talks, the talks of the quartet, was led by Tony Blair, and even U.S. bilateral engagement. I mean, think of how active secretaries of state were in getting the Israelis and the Palestinians to sit down. We haven't seen it, at least for the last, I'd say, 8 to 10 years. And because of that, I think that, and because of the distrust, I think, of the Netanyahu government, I think that there's just a lot of almost despair that the players in this have any kind of serious political solution. And it just seems to be only a military solution, which is leading to thousands of deaths of innocent civilians and millions of Israelis who are cowering in fear of more October 7th type attacks. I guess, the good news is that U.S. diplomacy and international diplomacy is fully engaged on this. You've seen the president go to the region. You've seen the vice president. You've seen Tony Blinken, the secretary of state, go multiple times. And I think there's a recognition among Israelis that there has to be a political solution to this, that Israel cannot survive with this kind of constant combat and missile attacks and brutal, savage attacks against Israelis, targeting them kind of retail as they did on October 7th. It's just not sustainable. There has to be a political process, and no one's talked about it for, as I say, 8 to 10 years, seriously, anyway.
What do you think? In just a couple of minutes, we need to take a break, but there was recently a ceasefire in which Hamas released hostages, including some young children and some elderly women, in exchange for Israel releasing people that it had held in prison for a range of things. And I should say that included teenagers throwing rocks and firebombs up to a woman who had been, I think, driving a car bomb. What do you think of this approach?
Well, it's encouraging. It's encouraging, first of all, because loved ones who are being held, either in detention or as in Israel or as hostages in Gaza, that they're able to be reunited with their families. And it's also encouraging that Israel is engaging on this through a political channel, through the government of Qatar. So the fact that they've been able to talk politically or diplomatically is encouraging, even if it's through an intermediary instead of face to face, which used to happen. And the other, I think, the other part of it is it's encouraging that the Israelis have allowed in all of this aid for the suffering displaced population in Gaza. I think that, you know, that's a very good sign that for the first time, and I don't know the exact amount of time it's been since direct talks between Israelis and Palestinians took place. I would say it's at least the Trump administration and the 3 years so far of the Biden administration, we even had these kind of talks. So this, it's encouraging that people are starting to think about the need to come up with a political solution. Encouraging.
We will continue when we return more with Ian Kelly, Ambassador in Residence at Northwestern University, 800-222-9455. If you want to join our conversation today, 800-222-9455. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are continuing our conversation with Ian Kelly, former high-level State Department official. He was a spokesman under Secretary Hillary Clinton. He went on to become a U.S. representative to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe and ambassador to the country of Georgia. Now he's ambassador in residence at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. 800-222-9455 is the number to join our conversation today. And I want to now turn to what's been happening in Ukraine and the American response and the waning American support, at least at, in certain factions within Congress. But also, so we got a question from Charlie in Urbana who wanted to hear, what would you say, explain it like I'm 15, ELI 15, they say on Reddit, an explanation of how the U.S. funds Israel and Ukraine historically and in the recent past. How does that actually work in practice?
Well, I mean, it works, first of all, through a congressional appropriation. And the last several large appropriations in 2022 and 23 went through fairly quickly. What has happened really since the last major issuance of billions of dollars in munitions and weapons is the stalling of the counteroffensive, the much vaunted counteroffensive, which the Ukrainians themselves said would be successful in 2023. President Zelensky said 2023 is the year of victory. Well, the offensive has been has not really kind of met the goals the Ukrainians set for themselves. They've only taken about 200 square miles of territory at the cost of thousands of dead and wounded and billions in American money. I think people are questioning why we should continue to pour money into Ukraine's fight. In terms of how the money is spent, I think that many Americans don't appreciate how much of this money actually goes to American firms. Because these are all American weapons and American ammunition, so it's billions of dollars for American companies, including companies in Illinois. So this is not the proverbial blank check or anything. This is to fund American factories, basically to provide these weapons like armor and artillery, and of course ammunition. So yeah, it's a difficult time because of the polarization in Congress and the kind of growing isolationist wing in Congress. But I think that in the end, the Congress will do what the right thing and give Ukraine what it needs to take back its own territory and impose a real cost to Putin's aggression.
You know, we had another question from Aaron in Springfield who wondered what would be the consequences of abandoning the protection of our ally, Ukraine?
Oh, it'd be terrible. It'd be absolutely terrible. You mentioned that I was ambassador to Georgia. So in 2008, Russia invaded Georgia and still occupies 20% of Georgian territory. And we did virtually nothing except lip service, wagging our finger at the Russians. And the lesson that Putin drew from that, and then again from his annexation of Crimea and invasion of eastern Ukraine in 2014, we did very little. We imposed some economic sanctions, but the Obama administration actually forbade, if that's the word, prohibited the transfer of lethal weapons to the Ukrainians in 2014. So the lesson that Putin drew from that is that he is not going to face real consequences for his aggression. And so that has real, I think it has real implications that if we stop supporting Ukraine, Putin will draw the conclusion that he can take back more of Eastern European territory, particularly the Baltic states, which used to be part of the Soviet Empire, and Poland, which is a longtime enemy of Russia, going back to the Russian Empire. And so it is just something that we don't want to do. We need to make sure that Putin pays a deep price for being the first European leader since 1939 to attack and annex and occupy the sovereign territory of one of its neighbors. This is a real existential moment for NATO, and I think for the international rules-based order in general. The Chinese will be looking at this too. So we could be in a 1941 situation if we don't stop Putin here, as we should have stopped Hitler and the Japanese Empire in the 30s.
So the Munich analogy is ringing in your head. You know, you've spent basically your entire career in government service during times when Republicans were the hawkish party, right, who believed that America needed to project strength and spread democracy around the world, although I might put the asterisk on there if the outcome of democracy suited our interests. What the heck has happened, in your view, the past 10 years?
It really is, as you point out, for somebody who, who had his formative years in international affairs under Ronald Reagan and the two Bushes, it really is. Just remarkable how things have turned 180 degrees in terms of which party is the party that wants a strong military and a strong response against aggression. I'm not a political pundit of domestic politics, but basically it's the rise of a populist wing of the Republican Party, in many ways reminiscent of the Republican Party in the 1930s. Its leading proponent, Donald Trump, even has borrowed a line from the Republican Party of the 1930s with America First. So it is just a little too interesting these days, I think, for my own sense of a calm and faith in the international system to see things kind of turned on their head now in terms of what American politics stands for.
I want to come back. Let me remind listeners first, actually, that we're speaking with Ian Kelly, ambassador in residence at Northwestern University. This is the 21st show. I want to come back to this idea we were talking earlier about hostages and prisoner exchanges. And it's a different issue with Russia than it is with Israel and Hamas. But, you know, this year we saw the U.S. release a notorious Russian arms dealer in exchange for a professional basketball player who'd been arrested for allegedly traveling with an illicit substance. Today, the front page of the Wall Street Journal is reminding us that the journalist Evan Gershkovitz has been held for 250 days on espionage charges, the first time a journalist has been held on that since the Cold War. And I should say, vehemently denied by Evan in the Wall Street Journal. Is this becoming normalized, this sort of kidnapping, how you want to call it?
Yeah, it's interesting, and I have to try and tamp down my tendency to see kind of Russian conspiracies. But it's interesting that this Hamas attack happened at the moment, really, in many ways, when the tide was turning in Ukraine. In terms of the counteroffensive failing, and it's been really remarkable how the events in Gaza have basically shoved the war in Ukraine off the front pages of American newspapers and of news broadcasts, and then you hear about the connection, you know, between Iran and Hamas, Iran being basically the financier of Hamas, and then the connection between Iran and the Kremlin, with Iran supplying most of the cruise missiles these days against the Ukrainians. So there does seem to be a kind of an axis here of I don't know what you'd call it, of aggression, of...
David Froom, who called it the axis of evil. I don't know if you want to go
that
route.
Well, that one's been used already. But yeah, in many ways, it is an axis of evil. So you can call it hostage taking, that what the Russians are doing with American citizens. It's not just Gershkovitz. There's also a former Marine named Paul Whelan, who has been arrested and convicted and is in prison on specious charges the American government has denied of espionage. And now there's a Radio Free Europe journalist who's an American citizen who's been detained. So yeah, I mean it's similar to trying to use hostage taking. It's just called for what it is with Gershkovitz and the other Americans in Russian prisons as a means to basically put the West back on its heels, and you know try to leverage these prisoners as a way to try and get the West to cave to Russian demands or to Hamas's demands, and just sort of highlight just how feckless the West can be when the U.S. gives up an arms dealer responsible for the deaths of hundreds of people in return, as you say, for an American basketball player. And then, of course, with Hamas, it's many more Palestinians are released than Israelis. So, I do see a pattern here of challenges to the West from these dictatorships.
Well, and it's, you know, we're at a time of such conflict. The Economist recently had a story, you know, pointing out we've got the largest war in Europe since World War II, significant conflict in the Middle East with America and Iran sort of in the background, China menacing Taiwan with an upcoming election in Taiwan, potentially leading to even higher tensions, not to mention internal conflict. So it's called civil conflict in Mali, Myanmar, Sudan. Talk about the interconnections of these conflicts.
Yeah, I think it's I think it's kind of a rise of kind of militarized authoritarianism in those places that you mention, and a kind of a fall in the confidence of the liberal form of government to really get things done, to address some of the kind of nativistic or populist prejudices against minorities, because a lot of this violence is directed against ethnic groups. You see the demonization of Ukrainians. You see you see the same kind of rhetoric about democracies, about the failure of democracies in China. I don't think that you can talk about some kind of some kind of NATO type alliance of dictators, but they certainly are, I think, seeing their moment in many ways, with a very distracted West. Not much attention being given to Africa, horrible wars in Sudan and other places in Africa now. The Azeris seeing the moment to solve the Nagorno-Karabakh problem with Armenia, but using military force. I think, as I say, a lot of dictators see that this is the moment to act.
And I'm glad you mentioned Sudan, just about a minute left. But yes, I mean, people, I know there's, international definitions, I'm sure, that come into play when using the term genocide. But yeah. I mean, this is another situation. We say never again, but we've proven that we don't really want to commit to that.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of these forces that whatever they're called, like the rapid reaction forces. It's just, these are, they go in and they massacre people. It's another very discouraging, thing going on, and we're not paying much attention to it because of all these other fires breaking out all over the world.
Yeah. Well, I'll say to our listeners, that is something we do plan to cover in an upcoming show, so stay tuned soon for that. Ian Kelly is Ambassador in Residence at Northwestern University. Thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st Show. Appreciate your time as ever.
Yeah, thank you, Brian. It's always very interesting and stimulating to talk to you.
I want to remind you to let us know what you think about what we have been talking about. You can keep in touch with us through our website, 21stshow.org. While you're there, we've got links to our voicemail, our email address, which is talk@21stshow.org. We love hearing what you're thinking about what we talk about. And if you see a story in your part of Illinois that you think journalists aren't doing a good enough job covering, let us know about that. Maybe it's something we can look into as well. Again, 21stshow.org. More to come after a short break. Stay with us.